what I've been saying just then, it's just made such sense of the place I was in at lunchtime, where I couldn't find where I was. There was something about the mystery and the entanglement or something. Anyway, maybe you repeat those words.
Let's come back to that then. So that's an interesting thing, right? Because this sense of... When we do an exercise like the exercise that we've just done, so in a certain sense we start off by getting present in the body, present with the senses, present with the shape of our body. So in a certain sense we're entering into the, if you like, the particle nature of our body, our particularity. And so, you know, you listen to your senses, you find yourself in the particular place that you're sitting in. Connected inwardly and outwardly, and we have this sense of the kind of the spine of sovereignty that upholds us and positions us. But then from there, it's like we expand from that center point into communion, into this conversation with the world around us. And that is like sort of moving, really, to use the quantum physics terms, moving from being the particle to being the wave. And in a sense, if you think about wind on water, or if you throw a stone into water, you get kind of ripples. Now, if you imagine, let's say we're in this kind of field, and we're rippling, so our intention out just to be there, here I am, creates ripples, creates a movement within the total field. And if we think that everything else is doing that as well, what you get is a great constellation of patterns of waves, dancing with each other, touching each other, colliding into each other, creating different shapes. And in a sense, what we do when we enter into grail space, when we connect to the objects in the room or things outside the room, or connect to the angels, or anything else, really, we're creating a particular kind of weaving that is like the sort of the chalice of the grail. It's the thing that can hold, it's a field of relationship that holds the quality of light and love and life and law. So it creates that sort of integrity, that kind of generative potential. And that then starts to sort of manifest through us. But in that place, our sense of self is less about fixity and form. We can return to fixity and form at any point. But we are kind of expanded into a conversation. And in a way, that's what I was saying earlier about the Celtic bards who, particularly the poem, The Dialogue of the Two Sages, which begins really with a young bard being trained in Scotland, and being trained to work with his senses, and because a lot of the training of the Welsh bards and the Scottish bards and the Irish bards was about opening their senses and coming into relationship with the universe and listening and talking, really. And so this particular poem, he's listening to the waves of the sea, and what he's doing is listening deeply into the waves of the sea. And so he's engaging with the waves, he's listening to the sound of the waves, smelling the salt, tasting the salt. He and the sea are talking to each other. And he's on the west coast, so he's looking across over towards Ireland, which is where his father lives. And he And in the poem it says that the waves bring to him the news that his father has died. And his father is the chief poet of Munster, and in the and he was expected to be the chief poet of Munster after him. And so he receives this kind of receives this sort of message. And acts upon it. So he goes home, he goes to Munster, and he finds that an older poet has now taken on the bardship of Munster. And the whole poem is about a dialogue, really, between the young poet and the older poet. It's worth reading something if you haven't come across. It's a beautiful poem. It's got a lot of bardic tradition in it and understanding in it of this what we're looking at here somewhere. And in the end, the older poet is confirmed in his place. Then the reason the older poet is confirmed in his place is that his poetry can encompass and include all the painful things of life, as well as the younger poet, who hasn't yet lived through some all of that, hasn't got the same understanding. But what that poem is about, it shows us some of the methods of the bard, where it's a bit like, it's kind of like a Celtic rap session, where they're giving each other kind of giving each other examples and I'll dig it out later and read you a selection of it, because it's a powerful kind of poem. But these poems are great, but what it's pointing at us into is something that does happen to us all the time. This sort of multi-leveled conversation. And anyway, this is the thing we get Jung talking about synchronicity it's being part of a speaking world. Talking with somebody yesterday who was South African and a friend of hers is South African, and they were talking in a way about some of the awful things they lived through. And in a way getting a bit caught up in it. And she said the door, they were in a little hut, and the door suddenly blew open and fresh air came blowing in. And a wren suddenly came bouncing into the room, which completely took their attention away from the place that they were in. And in a way that's the door was closed. I don't know, there's a bit of mystery, but it's a, in a sense they were, understandably they had both lived through some very difficult things. But they were suddenly, what happened is that energy from outside, that energy of the speaking universe comes in, not just literally as a breath of fresh air, which is kind of, good. But also as this magical little wren who just comes in, and the wren didn't stay very long, to bounce along, had a look at them both, flew out again. But had the effect, really, of taking them, bringing them right into the present, right out of the pain of the past. Now, it doesn't always happen as dramatically as that, does it? But I think we notice these things all the time. There's a way in which we we're impacted, and then we kind of shunt it to the side. Well, it was interesting, but so we diminish the overall impact it can have on us. And of course that's mainly to do with the way we, in our society, think of nature. We think of the world as, not as an ensouled world anyway, we think of it as a world that, yes, it can be beautiful and organic, but the sense of the inspirited nature of the world, the fact that the world does talk back at us. It is not something we're brought up to feel. And in a way, one of the interesting things, if you come back to the physics, really, the whole, if you think about, you know, Newtonian physics, it's all about billiard balls knocking into each other, fixed elements. And it's very, Newtonian physics is very effective. It's Newtonian physics that enabled us to create the steam engines, the Industrial Revolution wouldn't have existed without the understanding of Newtonian physics. And of course, one of the things that's always fascinated me, maybe a bit around Newton, is that the thing that he was most interested in was not his experiments in physics, but in his work as an alchemist. And so there's a whole kind of other side to Newton, which, you know, people are a bit embarrassed by and think of it as, oh well, this one is real work. But if you look at any decent biography of Newton, he was very seriously into the alchemical work of transformation. But the great beauty in some ways for our subject of the understanding of modern physics, quantum physics, and from Einstein on, where you get the ideas like relativity, where you get ideas of, so instead of, you know, if you think of just even the idea of the use of space and time that is developed, people used to think of gravity as a force coming out of the center of things, whereas what we now understand, that gravity is a distortion in the field of space-time. So that things rolled out. So the reason that we don't fly in the air is there's a great dip in space-time, so that we naturally roll towards the center. And, you know, so we're not doing what happens when you see people in the space flights where they don't have that. They're free of that particular shaping, so they're floating free in all kinds of ways. So the idea that gravity is a sort of a field phenomenon. And the great quote that Phil gave about, from Niels Bohr, about the, things are real. Of course things are real. Computer's real. I'm sitting on real. My cup is real. It contains my tea. But if I look deeply enough into it, there's nothing there. Well, there is something there, but there's nothing there. Right? So you enter into a kind of a mystery. Now, similarly, when we work with this exercise of veil space, we enter in, if you like, through the forms, the apparent forms of things, into a dialogue with the mysterious capacity that it is underneath that. So the universe, so one of the things that can happen to us when we do this is that the universe becomes less known and more mysterious. Because one of the problems that we have is the familiar form, where you stop perceiving, or rather your perceiving becomes dulled. Because you think, you look at, oh, that's that, I know that. You don't really look. You don't really perceive. You don't really look at it as it is now. You don't listen in quite the same way. Never forgotten being the first time I ever went to India. And we go off a plane at Delhi Airport. And the barrage of the unfamiliar. just kind of was quite overwhelming. Well, bodily overwhelming, because about three Indian blokes trying to grab me, rucksacked, and carried off to their cousin's hotel, who was going to do me a brilliant deal. But aside from that, it's just the barrage of the unfamiliar.
I love that expression. Is this the way to such and such?
Sure. No, exactly. Yes. But never mind, come with me. My cousin will help you out. You know, whatever you want, my cousin will help you out. But is this the way? It's a brilliant kind of ambiguous gesture, isn't it? No, I know, totally.
Two worlds just...
Oh, completely. But of course what happens is your body gets scared, I think, as well, and so it wakes everything up, because you're trying to say, oh my God, you know, what's going on here? What does that mean, that gesture? You know, so you're very, very aware in that kind of moment.
Yeah, totally.
Well, totally you are, because you're off kilter. And there's plenty of people there to help you with getting ripped off, should you be that way, should you want to. But it's a sort of, you know, anyway, we don't have to go to India to do this, fortunately. But, you know, so the point of the exercise where we revisit our senses and then relate to them things around us freshly. And what you can experience then is a sort of infinite depth. And a sense of the mysteriousness of our familiar objects. And in that, reflected back, of course, is our own mysteriousness, our own depth.
It feels quite scary to be in that place. It feels so unknown and vulnerable or something. It's just like, I don't know, what is this? Where am I? That sort of feeling.
Yeah, it's exactly that. It's that part of the art, really, is to be able to tolerate that vulnerability and that sense of dislocation. Because I'm beyond my normal, you know, and it's complicated because I'm in my room, I'm in my normal place, but it doesn't feel normal, it doesn't feel the same. It's a part of the practice there, is to learn to tolerate that and not to collapse back into the habitual experience.
That's one thing my client wrote with the image of a swift last week, which was like, when a swift hatches and leaves the nest in the summer, it won't land until it breeds again, which will be in 2 or 3 years' time. So it'll spend the next 2 or 3 years permanently airborne. They only land to breed. And it will fly down to Africa and back again, down to Africa and back again, maybe breed then, or go down to Africa and back again. And it's like, how can we... It's like a fish in water. It lives in the air. The whole shift of... and can we receive the love in the universe in that way? Like, be with completely alternate... Can we fall into that reality and not keep going back to what we know?
That's a lovely expression, isn't it? That's a lovely image of being... Because in a way, that extraordinary... and again, this is the way animals can teach us that extraordinary idea of the swift just doing that. And the analogy of that, that's a nice analogy you make there, but can we rest in the field of love like that?
And when there's nothing to grasp.
No, completely.
Just like the swift in the air, it doesn't need to grasp.
Yeah, no, completely, totally. No, absolutely, you're held up, and held up like a fish in water. It's amazing. It's an amazing image, isn't it?
They even sleep in the air. They sleep off half, they switch off half their brains at a time.
Peregrines,
lots of birds do it.
So in a way, there's that kind of adaptation, isn't there, to the kind of to the new world. You know, so you change, you become different. You become, the more you become able to rest in the sort of in the mysteriousness, your nature changes. So in a certain, so you may not literally switch off your brain, but you do something different with your brain. You do kind of, you know, because in a way, it's if you think of, you know, the left hemisphere and the right hemisphere, and we live in the cerebrum. You know, we, in a certain sense, part of what's needed is the switching on much more of the right hemisphere of the brain. Mm-hmm. So that we, like the swift, can rest in that mysteriousness. But that's such a good example, Rob, I think, really, of the way the world talks back at us, and actually you're using that image with your client. It's just a very powerful, you know, powerful image. Mm-hmm. Somewhere, and it's and in a way that's the, you know, there's so much in something like that, but we've got to be good. Yeah, go on.
Especially has to make that leap as well, doesn't it? That first leap,
and will the air hold me? You know, yeah. that you know, it's a sort of more like a splat. You know, so that's absolutely is about, you know, there's a lot of relationship with that subject about entering in the mystery, into the mystery. Will it hold me?
It also has to come back to the everyday to learn to breathe, doesn't it?
So. Yeah, that's right. So there is, of course, a point where to land is important, and land, you know, and sort of, and so to land as well. So it's not making, it's not never, but there are points where landing is important. So again, that's the sort of interplay, I guess, really, between the particle and the wave, and the known and the unknown. Let me ask any thoughts about, not just actually the things we're talking about today, but anything we've been looking at over these 2 years, because in next year I'm going to be looking very much at the way in which these traditions have turned up in the 20th century, and the 21st. But is there anything that needs revisiting, anything that people want to hear more about, or something that wasn't clear from the things we have looked at?
Maybe ask something, Ian. Yeah. In that grey space where you're connecting with things around you, how would you put that onto the tree, the tree of life?
Okay. What happens there is you're entering, you're in a sense, you're taking, if we look at that actual practice, we're entering into Malkut, we're entering directly into the senses, and we are connecting the senses up with our thinking, our feeling, and our imagining. But then we're opening ourselves toward into Tiferet. Because Tiferet is the part of the tree that connects to everything else. So what we're doing, in a certain sense, as we establish Malkut as the anchor, as we come into our senses, as we allow ourselves to perceive and experience ourselves and the world around us, means we have to work with our thinking and our feeling and our imagining. We're allowing that to kind of still, so we're creating that against a sense of stillness. We're aligning ourselves with the middle pillar of the tree. And we're opening, so it's like we're creating a kind of chalice because what we do is, having created that sense of stillness for ourselves, we're using our ability to perceive the objects around us. So we're quietening the activity of the mind and the feelings in order to enter into a much more direct sense of presence. And so the activity of Yesod, of Hod and Netzach quietens down. And then we start to be directly in contact with Tiferet, which connects to everything else. And from that, and it's from there then that the wider conversations start to happen. So that's a place where we think in our normal consciousness, we're caught up in our, so normally that the fulcrum of consciousness is Yesod, where it's, we have the image of myself and my world. And so if you think that's surrounded by Hod and Netzach and Malchut. Now Malchut, and certainly the mysterious aspect of the body is all the time receiving things in the present, in the immediate thing. But these impressions get taken up into the inner dialogue that exists between the thinking, cognitive mind in Hod, our emotional nature in Netzach, and our capacity to imagine and remember that you find in Yesod. Now that creates that spinning wheel that I often talk about, whose function it is to create stability. And so what that does is to filter and assimilate both inner and outer experience, in so that it doesn't, so that we're aware of it, but it dims it. It so that the underneath stability of the dialogue doesn't get disturbed. Now in this exercise, we stop that, for a little while we stop that spinning wheel. We open ourselves to something bigger and deeper, and we start to feel connected to everything. And that's different. So then what starts to happen then is the mind, instead of being the known mind, starts to acquire some of the clarity and insight that arises out of Gevura. The emotions start to become informed by that sense of love and kindness and open compassion. So that our emotional nature opens up. The very involved nature of Yesod with all the constellation of images starts to directly experience Da'at, the sphere of not knowing. So we start, and then as that continues, we then start to directly come into relationship with the non-dual love, the non-dual will, the non-dual of Bina and Chokmah, and the non-dual awareness of Keter. So the whole of our system opens. And so that we do find ourselves in mystery, in mysteriousness. And then when we return from that, we come, you know, it's like our form reconstitutes itself. But what comes with it is the echo of mystery, the scent of mystery, the taste of mystery. So when we do it again, it's a little easier to do it again. Yeah. Yeah.
I suppose I just wanted to add in that there feels something about time and all. Yeah. Something about time and what happens to time in that place. And whether, I know this is sort of basic, sort of almost like a misunderstanding, but almost like the amount of time that needs to be spent there.
Can you say a bit more about that?
Yeah, no, I'm not really sure. I think I'm just very much with, I would be very happy to continue in that space in these meditations. But I also realise just sort of continuing to be in that space that almost like indefinitely for is somehow not the point. And yet there's a sort of feel of in that space where it becomes slightly timeless.
It does become timeless. It's complicated. This.
Yeah.
Because in a certain sense, what happens is that we, as we go more deepen into this, we come into timelessness. And so there is that, and time does do strange things when we're doing, you know, meditation like this. Sometimes you feel like it's gone on forever. You'll find that 5 minutes have gone, or vice versa. You can think 5 minutes have gone, you've been doing it for half an hour, or more. So you're in, time as a dimension of consciousness. And again, that's just part of the discovery of the mystery of things. So that the, because in a way, that, you know, it's quite simple practice in lots of ways, but actually if we go with it and open into it, it takes us more and more into the mystery of things and in particular, the sense of being in an universe that responds to us, but also a mysterious universe that responds to us.
Yeah.
You know, so it's quite a, and so things like time and space and become kind of different.
I think where I'm with it is that the process needs to be given time, though.
Oh, the process, I see what you mean, yeah. Oh, the process, yes, of course, does need to be given time, of course. Yeah, no, absolutely. Because one of the issues, one of the things we're working with is the momentum of our ordinary way of thinking and feeling and imagining, which is, you know, so working with it requires time and patience. And
then almost conversely, once that's quieted down, being in Grail space, being in a different space doesn't require time, but benefits from having time, something like
that. Only a benefit absolutely from having time by being able to immerse ourselves in that.
Mm.
Right, and so as we're immersed in that, you know, we become, you know, a bit like Rob Swift, really, we become kind of aware of it. It can feel more like home rather than strangeness. And so as we come out of that, we bring with us that sense of the ability to be there. And that helps us next time we perform the exercise and sort of in, because in a certain sense, it's almost by marinating in that sense of mystery that really does disrupt the nature of the ongoing dialogue.
What's behind this question?
Yeah.
I've also noticed on retreat that when you get that still, it's such a relief, especially when you're first practicing from the sort of busyness and chaoticness of the self, and then after a while that I think, oh, this is great, I just want my whole life to be like this sort of still place. And then after a number of trees, actually I'm beginning to get bored now. I want to re-engage in the world and have a laugh and reconnect and live a life as well. So it's going back and forth, isn't it? So
yeah, yeah, it is going back and forth.
It can get too hallowed, can't it? Attachment to emptiness.
Yeah, well that's the other side of the coin then, isn't it? Where you end up in a retreat, instead of being in the dialogue, you kind of have retreated somewhere. And it's very tempting to do that sometimes, of course.
There's something in this. Another physicist comes to mind, you know, with Einstein, you know, proving with relativity that time, well, it's space-time, they're aspects of the same shape. And that it's relative, you know, time is relative. And when we sit, I'm not quite sure where this is going, but when we sit and we become present in ourselves, and we're here and we're now, that time becomes, I don't know, something dis- well, I suppose it's that now and here, isn't it? No, now and here make nowhere.
Yeah.
And it's, there's something about, as I say, I don't really know, there's something about space and time which is another aspect of the mystery, I guess. Well, beyond that, I don't know. What anyone does.
Time is also how we perceive it, isn't it? Because we were working with giants last time where that sense of time is much slower. And birds perceive time, birds perceive time very, very much quicker than us. They slow it down. They see it in more frames per second, and that's how they move so fast.
Yeah.
So you look at it, when I film little birds and they're moving, and it's very jerky, but when you slow it down, it's all very deliberate and much more like we could relate to it when it's slowed down. So their sense of time is completely different to ours.
No, and when you look at insects as well, of course, so that's even more so the case. You look at dragonflies, for example.
Yeah.
So that in a way, all of these things, if we can let ourselves listen to them, really take us into the kind of the mystery of the universe. As opposed to these categories. Because, I think, of course, what we learn when we're little is a way of, this is how things work, right? So we learn this. And then we just sort of, that becomes the unquestioned background. Whereas in these practices, these exercises, these uses of the imagination, we question the fundamental assumptions. And that makes things shake. It makes our sense of self shake. It shakes our sense of the universe. But it opens us, in a way that's kind of, that's the point. It continually opens us to something that's beyond us.
I think it does change your sense of relationship with, when you're back in the world, there's an incremental sort of shift more to that. Like the Francis of Assisi, it's a sort of brother, son, sister, moon type thing. It just that sense of, of kind of relationship and sort of with the small things around us, and that's easier in a way with living things. But perhaps it sort of takes longer with the inanimate world. And
yes, I think that's true, and I think that's obviously the point Faye was making as well. But I love your invocation of Saint Francis, because actually, St. Francis absolutely had this kind of, constantly in relationship with everything around him somewhere, and so he's really participating in that conversation. It's interesting, you take that phrase, brother, son, sister, moon, take it seriously, that's a bit awesome.
Sorry, say that expression again, Ian.
St. Francis used to talk, about brother, son, sister, moon. Right, so he'd call the son, he'd experience the son as his brother, the moon as his sister. And he would experience animals and birds in exactly the same way. So he was constantly in that kind of colloquy with them. And it is just, but if you just take that phrase, that brother, son, and sister, moon, and really take that seriously, I mean, that's an extraordinary thing to say. It's too big, a very big thing to say, which kind of overturns our understanding. So that's somebody relating to the sun and moon as brother and sister.
Went to I forget the name of the church there now, where he had got the stigmata when he was living in the cave in Italy, and really, really powerful place to be. Really magical. There's fantastic trees reaching up.
Thank you.
If we come back again to Merlin for a moment, you know, if we look at, you know, the Vita Merlini, we look at these very early stories around Merlin, you see this constant inquiry. You know, so that, the thing I like really about the Vita Merlini in particular is it begins with an inquiry into the nature of war and death. And his, Merlin's experience of the young nephews being killed. And his inability to deal with that. Well, not inability really. Actually, in some ways his ability to be impacted by that. And to not be shut off from it. And so his retreat into the woods of Celadon, really, and then what you see are these constant, numbers of conversations, you know, which are relevant to what we were saying, you know, this morning. So you get this moment in the story of Merlin, where winter is coming, where the leaves are falling off the trees, his wolf is dying, and he cries out, you know, well, why does this have to be? Why are things like this? And in a way, there's that, you know, that this whole journeys that Merlin undertakes between the sort of the wood and the city, that eventually results in this strange place that's an observatory in the middle of a wood, which is like an integration between the city and the wood, and between the depth and the height. You know, it's a sort of intensity of life. It's a kind of dark place, really, where everything kind of comes together. But it's predicated on all this kind of questioning and kind of and in a sense, really, the what you see happening in the apparent persona of Mabella is everything is stripped away from him. You know, he begins as a Celtic warrior in a great battle, who is a king, and his kingship is one of the first things that vanishes, and his warriorship goes kind of with that, and he becomes the wild man of the woods. You know, living on nuts and following his, you know, there are various animals associated with him there. There's the little pig, there's the wolf. You know, so he's learning a different way to be. You know, he renounces his sexuality at one point, but, you know, so his, and that's kind of an interesting thing that happens there, because what he renounces is not like kind of the Christian almost sort of sexuality is wrong. What he's renouncing is his image of Gwendolina. So Gwendolina is the sort of, if you like, the, in his mind, is the kind of, isn't really a person, she's a beautiful image. You know, and there's something about that going, that being taken away. And and then there's this very powerful process that happens when he's chained up in the city, where he's seeing through, if he's in the city, he's beaten and he really wants to escape, but he's being held, and you're like, in the world, or the world, if we were in physics language, we'd say the world of particle reality. But he's seeing through that to the deeper waves, the deeper functions, the things that are underneath the surface. So that, you know, for example, he sees that his sister's been having an affair. And that stimulant, and in order to prove to her husband that she isn't, she decides to prove that Merlin is mad, which is, because it's not a difficult thing to do given what he's done. But you then get this kind of powerful kind of sequence, which are where you have this idea where and you get these laughs. You know, it's one of the things that's associated. Some of the legends of Merlin is Merlin's laugh. So there's this kind of laugh that kind of cuts through everything. It kind of sees the deep humour of everything. Probably dark humour, it has to be said. You know, so that one of the laughs is about he's looking at a poor man sitting in front of a gate, and he doesn't know that underneath the gate there's a great treasure trove. And that's got a lot of meanings in it. You know, that's got about how you don't cultivate your own treasures, you don't dig down into your own soil to know what's there, but it's also really about the fact that hoards were buried in those days and people could come across them. Or there's the image of the drowned sailor, the young man buying patches for his shoes, which will never be needed because he's about to be drowned. And then it culminates in this kind of very central image of the, this is a coup de grace, really, where she proves that Merlin is mad, because she presents the same person three times, and Merlin prophesies a different death each time. So the first time he just presented, and he says he will die from hanging from a tree. Dresses the person in different clothes, and says he will die from falling from a height. Third iteration is that the person then made up to look like a woman, dressed in woman's clothes, and as he is presented, Merlin says he or not, will die from drowning in a pool. And of course, you know, Ganeda uses this, looks the same person, he's mad, he doesn't know what he's doing. And then we get this very kind of very powerful kind of image of the hunt, which is a very ancient sacred thing in Celtic tradition, really. It's the boar hunt. In particular, there's a hunt of the white stag, which leads you to the grail. But this particular young man, who was the subject of all three of these exercises, chases the stag, and goes and is thrown off his horse, so falls through the air, his foot is caught in the fork of a tree, and his head swings down into the pool, and is drowned. So he is, in fact, he dies from hanging from a tree, falling from a height, being drowned in a pool. And in a way, this is a description within Geoffrey Monmouth's time of the ancient threefold death, which is the sacred death. But in the subtlety of this image, which actually has extraordinary similarities with the hangman of the tarot pack, the world is turned upside down. And just as with the tarot card, if you turn the tarot card, the hangman upside down, the tarot card could look, the person could look like they're dancing and not dying on a tree. So there's there's all kinds of reversals that happen in this, and the Merlin traditions in particular deal with a lot of reversals. And it's that reversal that happens, that when we move from our fixed sense of self and how we think we are into this much wider, much more kind of, and yes, vulnerable, but bigger and deeper and wider sense of self, operating in a bigger and wider and deeper sense of the universe. And the thing is that one of the things that's very important, if we just start getting interested in the wave-like nature of things, not just in meditation, but just in just ordinary experience, and look at and start to notice connections, it does start to freak you out a bit, because it does, because there's so many of them. There's a friend of mine who's just sort of sold his house. It's a very, very, very expensive house. And he's sold it immediately, within a day of being put on the market. And the people buying it, one of the things he was concerned about is that in selling this house, some years ago he'd planted an oak tree, which has become really, you know, as a sapling, has become really established. And originally it came from an acorn. He said they had it for many years. He decided to plant it, and it's rooted itself. It's now quite a well-established oak sapling. And as you know, oak saplings take a long time to grow. And he didn't want to take it with him, because he didn't, you know, the tree feels very happy where it is, and the acorn it comes from is from a place called it's up in Derbyshire, a place called Robin Hood Stride, which has a sort of megalithic circle and connected to legends of Robin Hood. And the people buying this land, buying this house, their great grandfather used to own the field that this acorn comes from. And so they were delighted to hear that there's an acorn from that field that is now a tree that will be in the house that they're now buying. Now that's freaky, isn't it? Well, I mean, that's sort of, you think, oh my God, what? You know, so there's, you know, it's as well as having an experience, is that actually when we take just that sense of noticing what sounds like coincidence, and without having to make a lot out of it, right? So I don't, you know, we don't have to say, well, that means this or that means that. It's in fact, in some ways, if you do that, it kind of disappears the experience a bit. If you just could be with the genuine freakiness of somebody selling a house, and one of his concerns is that the new people might, you know, and should I take my tree with me? I don't want it to do. The tree looks very happy where it is, and then this tree has an ancestral connection with the people buying the house. Now that's kind of mad, really. And so when you let yourself perceive that, it that in itself starts to take you into that wave-like reality. And you see, when you look, and then, of course, we're not trained to that. You know, one of the things that's interesting about the way physics developed, really, is if you think about Einstein for a moment. Much of Einstein's work was done through imaginative exercises. And yes, okay, then he uses mathematics and things to create mathematical proofs later, but in imagining himself as an electron, or imagining himself moving through time. These are his kind of practices, really, that bring him into a different understanding of how the universe works. And that understanding, you know, really maps onto and connects to the way the ancient Celts could, you know, when we look at some of these old poems, and you just see this, as I say, the Dialogue of the Two Sages is a really good example of that, because you just see this kind of this strange interplay of things, but not just that. If you look at some of the Book of Kells, which I've been looking at a bit just recently, and you look at these extraordinary illustrations, and you just, without getting into what they mean or any of that, if you just look into the way one thing feeds into another, one thing is connected to another. There are spirals, there are squares, there are layers and layers of things, all of which connect back and forth into each other. So obviously the artist doing this was an extraordinary artist, But it also gives you a glimpse into a way of seeing and being that that person had in order to be able to create these extraordinary kind of forms. And it's not just the big forms, even in the sort of the scribal letters, you know, you'll get sort of little images arising out of in corners of letters or kind of and so this sense of everything being a woven and connected flow. And in a way, that's the sort of, had we been brought up with that kind of understanding, it makes the wave-like reality much easier for us to access. But we haven't been. We've been brought up into a kind of into a way of thinking where the particle reality is dominant instead of being complementary. And you see, it's when we then look at physics, and we look at what modern physics is telling us, and modern physics is very hard-edged. You look at things like quantum computers, and these are the kind of computers you need that the AI operates out of. Well, I don't understand them, so I can't give you an understanding of them. I'm not a scientist in that way. But the reason they call them quantum computers is because they are built on the developed around the principles of quantum physics. So they're much faster, they can multitask more, they're able to, the speed is enormous because of their quantum nature.
It was announced this week, just a few days ago, that a new quantum computer, they've developed a new quantum computer I don't understand it, but it's based around these things called qubits. Let's call them particles, for want of a better word. And because they're all in kind of superposition and they can all be everywhere, they somehow managed to make it that they can solve. They can solve problems in a few milliseconds that normal computers would take longer than the age of the universe to solve.
Yeah, that's right.
But the problem with them is what's called decoherence, is where the background bleeds in, and these things have to be kept in very incredibly cold at like 0 degrees Kelvin or whatever it is, and after a very short time, up to now, they decohere and it just fizzles out. But they're still incredibly powerful, but they just invented, and they normally last like less than a millisecond, but in that time they can do some incredible calculations. But apparently they've now got to a point where they can keep these qubits stable for 20 seconds.
Oh wow, really?
Which is mind-blowing. You think how much a computer can do in 20 seconds?
Yeah, that's enormous. Absolutely. Yeah. Go on, yeah.
That literally just been announced this week. Wow. So that's quite incredible.
And of course, what that shows us, obviously, we're not going to be quantum scientists, but what that shows us is something about the nature of the universe. Okay, and something about certainly something about the mystery of time there, doesn't it? Because in 20 seconds, one of those computers can do extraordinary things. So, but they can do extraordinary things already, even before that. Because they can last only a few seconds, but, because in a sense it is this whole idea of the way of like superposition of things that enables multitasking is too small a word for it, really. But that relies upon, what that's relating to, is the deep structure of the universe. So it's not about us becoming quantum scientists or having to do that, but it is all of that point, about like the Swift, Bob Swift, it points us at the nature of how things are.
Just kind of how you really align, when you're in love, everything seems to come back to, you seem to be so much more profoundly connected when you're in that open place, where you are.
Well, of course, that's true. Really. And so when you're in that, the heart opens, everything is alive. You know, your senses are refreshed. When you're very sad, the universe acquires a very different tonality. Mm-hmm. And you know, in a way, you know, the practice, really, that these practices that we're looking at are about how to keep on developing the capacity to be with whatever, really, whether it's sadness or joy or love,
yeah,
or anger or whatever, but to allow that to move through us so that we don't get stuck in iterative loops.
Yeah, it's easy to connect when you're in love, but not when you're really hurt. Not when you're hurting. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think the whole point of when you're hurting is you have to be with the hurt. You have to be with the awareness of that. You know, you need to distract yourself from that, of course, and to not be in it. Other times you have to let yourself be in it. But the key thing is not to get stuck in the iterative loop. Because if you're not in the iterative loop, you're in a spiral. So that image of the straight spiral image we use often is an image of progress, of movement. It's not linear. It's not the closed loop. It's the combination of linearity and circular movement that creates the sort of the, if you like, the flash of insight that cuts through, and then the integration of that through the movement of the spiral.
Mm. When once with the song of the blackbird can sing to me when I'm happy, and it can sing to me when I'm sad. It can still be a song, I can still commune with, receive the song from however I am, and that conversation.
So I'm just coming back to Merlin for a minute, actually, because that's the, you know, the answer. I've had like the Book of Job, but the answer to Merlin, why are things like this, is that, you know, Minerva and Taliesin turn up and show Merlin the creation of the world. So, and what they show is this powerful, and it's been very medieval in its shape, really. We wouldn't think of it quite the same way now, but what's being shown is that powerful weaving and interweaving. The mysterious nature of everything. And the you know, the fourfoldness of the seasons, the four winds of heaven, you get the same kind of, and it's fascinating, Merlin, because you, in the prophecies of Merlin, which is part of the history of kings of Britain, here you get shown the creation, the prophecies, you get shown the apocalypse, the everything returning back into the womb of the goddess Ariadne, who's in the Welsh tradition to be called Arianrhod, the goddess of the spinning wheel, but who is the weaver goddess, and who is the sort of the, so this sense of and the last thing that happens before everything vanishes completely is the four winds come together in a great clap, so that kind of as they return into the womb of Ariadne. So you're shown really in the Merlin teachings in particular, give us a really different take on the whole of the Arthurian tradition, I think. And a sense of you, and you see within that, you see these very powerful, goddess figures at work. So you have Ariadne in one place. We have in the Vita, we have Ganida herself, who is the magical woman who directs most of the action and who joins together with Merlin in the observatory, and they then prophesy things together. In a way, this is the stuff you then find later in the kind of the French material and later in Mallory, where the divine feminine principle gets a bit demonized and turns up as the wicked Morgan Le Fay, who kind of, and the faithless Guinevere. Whereas these are actually ancient kind of divine figures, really.
Now, Professor, I have a question.
Yeah, definitely.
Which might be a bit off the way. Would you say the end of the story, it all goes back to where we had New
York?
Yeah. To go away, respond to that. Like.
Yeah.
I was thinking, there's so many rubbish dumps, you know. Huge rubbish. In this country, in this rotting land. And I just wondered if that'd be part of that in a way, coming back into the land, and I suppose what will happen with it because it's so poisonous and so on. Anyway, I just thought
Well, I think, in a way, that's interesting, isn't it? Because I think there's something about the necessity for the breaking down of things, the returning of things into elements. And of course, one of our problems is our industrial processes mean that things persist instead of rotting down and returning into fundamental elements. You know, I often think, really, when you see these Clouty trees, when the magical trees where people will tie things to. And the old idea of that used to be, you had a bit of cotton that would rot away. And as it fell off the tree, hopefully the illness or the thing you're suffering from would go with it. Whereas what we now do is we tie bits of plastic onto trees that will never decay. And in a way, that's part of this idea of one of the root ideas, I suppose, of capitalist culture is you build up and you build up and you keep what you have and you don't get rid of it and you don't allow that kind of necessary principle of destruction and rotting, which refreshes the world.
You can't say in the past, right, now we have rubbish dumps with plastic and things that won't degrade, but back in the day, and I've dug a number of them over the years, you get middens.
Yeah.
The midden was a healthy thing.
Yeah.
Where you threw your rubbish, but it was all, there was nothing that wouldn't rot down eventually, or at least be, non-toxic. So, I've dug middens that are like 4 feet thick of pure oyster shells, because people used to be a lot of oyster. But it's like it was a good thing. Like the balance was was maintained, yeah. Hidden in the middle.
Oh yeah, totally. So the very, yes, exactly. So the out of sight, but they're non-toxic.
Can I share something? It feels related, and in another way not. But I've just finished, and I think Andy was saying the word weaving or spinning, something like that. So I have just finished Jaffa's Blanket.
Oh, wow.
Which we know the idea is that it will be her shroud, because she's 15, and when she goes... So it kind of felt, I don't know, something about the dear animals that are with us. And of course, this was spun from the sheep in the village. So something about one thing turning into another. And all, it kind of feels really good that it's finished today with all, this being the last session that we, well, tomorrow... But, so something about what gets woven in or knitted into this as well. And because I'm not a general knitter, this feels like a very special thing. So it kind of feels like a magical process in itself that feels part of this work.
Well, definitely, and it's a sort of, you know, very magical and poignant garment in a sense as well, isn't it? It's a blanket, hopefully will keep her warm for quite a while. But also you will use it as a shroud, you know, and so it's
it will go into the earth.
Yeah, it will go into the earth, but you know, it's part of what we were saying earlier. So there's something about that. There's just something about this whole idea of weaving. And you know, the coming of... There's a great exhibition at the American Museum just outside Bath at the moment. It's a place that has they have a lot of quilting. It's a quilting exhibition, and it's a special exhibition of the women of a particular town in the south, the black women on an island, who they're quilting in America. American quilts are often very fancy and very high status, and these are very poor people. Who have created the most astonishing kind of objects by weaving, by sewing things together, patching things together, whatever they had to hand, really. And they've created the most magical, powerful kind of just extraordinary looking objects, really. You know, they're kind of they're. Let's see if I've got one on my photo stream, because it's... Photo stream now. I always have difficulty finding this.
They're very untraditional, aren't they, in terms of the American precision?
Yeah, yeah, they are.
Much more freestyle and...
Yeah.
They're not convincy.
Oh, yeah, totally, yeah, they're... Sure. So here's an example of one of these quilts. Where they are, as Andy's saying, they are quite wonky, but they're kind of extraordinary.
Wow!
A real potent kind of weaving of, and you can see there's just bits and pieces they put together.
Hexagons, they're not as ordered as that.
Either. No, not at all. No, it's absolutely. And there's a there's another one here. Look.
That's a female tradition, isn't it?
Yeah, it's an all female tradition. Yes, exactly. Of black working class women, black rural women.
Mm.
It's really kind of amazing.
Amazing.
I was thinking about how with those quilts, it's something about economy. So they're using all the last scraps they have to make something beautiful. And it was making me think about how the conversation that you've been having, or the things you've been talking about, how it's actually really, really difficult to create something completely random. But when you try, a pattern often emerges. And Oscar was telling me how they were training AI to be very random. The only way they could do it really was by having a kind of incredibly vast warehouse full of lava lamps. And the computers would look at the patterns that the lava lamps were making to try and imitate the randomness, because the universe has actually got such a mysterious level of pattern in it. So those quilts are kind of like, you know, there's something beautiful and something that looks very cohesive that comes out from pieces of fabric and chance, you know, economy and need. I just find that really fascinating. It sort of brings me back to the meditation of how when you're really in that, the connection with everything feels very meant to be, like it's not just chance by chance or what, but yeah.
Yeah, totally. No, completely. But I think that's what I mean about the meaningful, you know, so there's, if we look at something like one of those quilts, you see a sort of, that's just from disparate element, when some can't see them without getting quite close to some. Some are just bits of jeans. They're literally using what they have to hand. There's a great video going, a 50-minute video to watch where they talk, showing their work, talking about their work. And you do just see this kind of, this weaving, this bringing things together. And from these random elements, you see this extraordinary kind of magical, surreal, transformative shape that has its own coherence. You know, and it was interesting because that same day we'd be looking in the American Museum, and there's some very beautiful things there, but they're much more mannered somewhere, much more kind of, they've got a very particular shape, this is how you do it, and they're beautiful, I think that I love those as well, but I was absolutely blown away by this kind of, this randomness, this creativity, this kind of, it just felt like it was so much more in touch with the kind of, the rawness of life, the deeper magic of life somewhere.
It's almost like a reminder that came up on my phone about, and this isn't just the magical side of life, because what popped up on my phone was an advert from Marks and Spencer's, and I thought, oh, for goodness sake, in the middle of this. But I looked at it, and it was advertising cotton and linen garments. So even there, you know, the connection with the natural products. Mm. So Marks and Spencer's and the mystical seem a long way away. But it's all part of the whole, isn't it?
It is, and of course, the women I'm talking about grow cotton and pick cotton and work with cotton. You know, so the way that there's a direct connection there, you see. I think that's what I mean. I think that the sort of levels of connection that are mysterious, once you just let yourself pay attention, they're sort of everywhere. And so it doesn't have to be just something magical or something particular or something that's just in Glastonbury or somewhere. Marks and Spencer suddenly becomes a vehicle for a mysterious message.
Wasn't it St. Michael's as well?
It was also St. Michael's Day clothing range. It's be called St. Michael's, is right.
Yeah.
It's with the hand of the Archangel Michael somewhere in it.
I thought with a friend on Archery, his son got very dubious political views. He's quite to the right, which is very uncomfortable. His surname is Tricky, which seems to be connected with jesters historically in medieval times. And he really is a wild card kind of guy. There's lots of, he really intuits things and gets this kind of territory lot. So he's a real mixture of all sorts of things. It's good.
Can I come back to rubbish dumps? toxic material in them. I'm trying to imagine what can come of that, or is that a mystery in a way? Because, I don't know if we could say anything to that. It bothers me.
It's complicated, isn't it? I think that there's some things that things are a mystery. So I think that there is something about the toxicity of modern life. There's something about the, because in a certain sense, the mindset that creates all of this, where does this come from, this toxicity, comes out of the 18th, 19th century colonialism and that attitude of treating the world as an object to be used rather than something to be partnered with. And in a way, I think the we're dealing in lots of ways, and climate change is also part of that as well. We're dealing with the consequences of the dominance of that mindset in the world. And the and so the answer to these things is not a simple answer. It is an answer that arises out of different ways of thinking, different ways of being. And we're not there yet. We're in the middle of something. In fact, what we're experiencing mostly at the moment is the resurgence of those old ideas, in part as a reaction to the idea that something very new and very different is happening in the world. So people are threatened. So that terrible thing that happened to that young man who got knifed. You know, you're getting sort of J.D. Vance and Elon Musk kind of using this as proof positive. And this is a brilliant thing, isn't it? It is what we know about policing in Britain. Proof positive that the British police are biased against white people. That's just so mad. But it's that kind of, you know, it's part of what we're engaging with at this time in the world, I think, is the reaction to these deeper ideas that are undoing the old certainties. And in response and as a reaction to those old certainties, people are retrenching into old positions. And that's why we're seeing kind of, you know, fascist dictators appearing all over the place, because people look for the strong man to look after them and want to blame the other, because the world's becoming too complicated for them and too mysterious for them. And so in a certain sense, the answer is, well, you know, there's no simple answer, Andy, but I think the answer is in the new ways of thinking, new ways of being. The problem, most of us won't, certainly I don't expect to see that, because I'm too old. You know, I hope in the generations after us, the world will be a very different place. And I have faith in that. I have faith in that there's this new and different way, because I found it on a deeper reality, a deeper understanding. They found it on that which is true. And in a way, that's sort of the point of, if you listen to the universe, listen to this, start to allow in that kind of consciousness, that wave-like consciousness, that in that sense of total entanglement, total connectedness. It supports us in our being nature, in being in the world that's emerging, as opposed to the world that's passing away.
Can I mention something, Ed? Just in relation to Andy's point. I'm trying to find it on Netflix. There's a documentary about a guy called Paul Stamets, who's a mushroom. So I'm an expert in mushrooms. And one of the things he's found is that by planting different crops of mushrooms near things like oil spills or dumps, they break down all the stuff that wouldn't naturally break down on its own. So they're actually, obviously it's not been adopted in a wide mainstream way, but it is beginning to be looked at as a way of dealing with that sort of level of toxicity.
Well, that's lovely
to hear. That's really interesting. I'll see if I can find the documentary, I'll drop it in the chat.
Yeah, that'd be great. Oh, that's very fascinating. That's really interesting.
I think that's the real struggle, what you were just saying there, isn't it? Not to want it to be right in our lifetime. That's the hard thing to let go.
Yeah.
Okay, let's have a break for a cup of tea and come back just after 4 o'clock. And we'll see what we're going to do next. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks, Duncan.